Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The wars of the future and the wars of the past. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Defense Secretary Gates wants to cut projects that provide jobs in 44 states, including California. We'll hear about upcoming battles over a defense budget that reorients the Pentagon from conventional warfare to counterinsurgency. Also on Which Way L.A., what about illegal immigration? Does the president have a policy to placate his Hispanic base without stirring populist anger? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The Obama administration has new rules for immigration enforcement, but so far they're secret. Is the midst of an economic recession the best or the worst time to raid businesses in search of illegal workers? That story at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. As we talk about this year's Pentagon budget, remember this. The U.S. spends more on the military services, their arms and equipment, than the rest of the world's nations combined. And that spending may well go up, despite cuts in some high-profile programs in what Secretary Robert Gates calls a reform budget.
These recommendations are the product of a holistic assessment of capabilities, requirements, risks, and needs for the purpose of shifting this department in a different strategic direction.
Again, that was Secretary Gates talking yesterday to reporters as he released his new budget. Spencer Ackerman covers defense for the Washington Independent. That is a progressive news service in Washington. And Spencer Ackerman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of the highlights of this budget?
What absolutely the highlights are that Gates has done two really important things. First, he's decided to privilege support for the current wars that the U.S. fights in Iraq and Afghanistan against what some of the services would have liked the future to look like. And then specifically inside of that, he's decided to cut some of the most criticized or problematic or Cold War era weapon systems in the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, as well as in the Missile Defense Agency, in order to get this rebalance that he's talked about for quite some time.
Is he going to get into a fight with Congress over this?
Absolutely, and it's already seeming to start right now. Some of I don't want to say status quo, but some members of Congress on both the Democratic and Republican side of the aisle have expressed either opposition in the form of James Inhofe, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, saying that he would outright oppose the budget, and lukewarm support in the form of a statement put out yesterday by Ike Skelton, who's the Democrat from Missouri who chairs the Armed Services Committee, and he called it a well-intentioned, good first step, but didn't really signal that he was particularly enthused by the budget, and said that he would be working with Gates and would demonstrate that Congress has the proper place for where the buck stops.
Let's talk about some of the specific cuts. I guess the one that's had the most attention is the Air Force F-22.
That's right. The F-22 is a system designed in the Cold War. It's a fighter jet. Given that the United States doesn't face any sort of air battle right now or face a threat from what are called peer competitor nations or would-be peer competitor nations, you know, nations with large armies or with advanced militaries, think China, Russia, increasingly India, you don't really see much in the way of air combat, and that caused a lot of people to wonder why the Air Force was so enraptured by the F-22 Raptor. Gates had a very interesting series of statements about the F-22. Basically, he decided that he was going to cap the program at the 187 total of planes that are both the Air Force either has now or is got on order, and the program would stop, replace it with a program called the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which defense reformers think is a better plane and is more applicable to kind of current and likely future threats while still, you know, hedging against military challenge that would come in a more conventional form. The end of the F-22 is a really significant step. Some reports from before the review was announced that Gates undertook, suggested that he would leave it out. The Air Force made a point of saying it wanted something on the order of 60 more planes, and that's not going to happen.
And Ike Skelton, as you indicated, a very powerful member of Congress in this regard, says the buck stops at Congress, not with the Pentagon. So that was sort of an announcement of the kind of opposition that there might be. The secretary spoke of shifting the department in a new strategic direction. What did he mean by that?
It's a direction that contends the likely threats to American security are going to come through the form of irregular challenges. Low-tech enemies that would take advantage of American military dominance on the order of what you see from Al-Qaeda and its allies fighting the U.S. in Afghanistan, from the insurgencies that we've seen over the last several years in Iraq. And one of the points that Gates made yesterday was that when it came time to support the soldiers and Marines primarily who are fighting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Pentagon didn't really have institutionalized processes for responding to those needs. Think the famous hillbilly armor moment in 2005 when a soldier told Donald Rumsfeld, then the defense secretary, that he and his comrades were outfitting their Humvees with armor that they had scavenged from scrapyards and so forth. And other programs like the Pentagon's rather impressive effort over the last couple of years to combat IEDs, things like these came, as Gates reminded people yesterday, sort of against the grain of the Pentagon's regular procurement and acquisition process. The Pentagon didn't sort of stop what it was doing. The services didn't reevaluate what their procurement needs were according to the wars that the U.S. was actually fighting. Gates took a step yesterday for saying that Iraq and Afghanistan, those type of challenges, are probably more the rule for the near future of American war fighting than they are the exception.
Again, Spencer Ackerman, a senior reporter with the progressive web magazine The Washington Independent. That's part of the Center for Independent Media. Winslow Wheeler is director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. He was served in the Congress as a staff assistant for 30 years dealing with military affairs on both sides of the aisle. He's author most recently of America's Defense Meltdown, Pentagon Reform for the New President and Congress. Winslow Wheeler, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
What about this new strategic direction? Is that this the right way for the Pentagon to go?
Well, if you liked the strategic direction George Bush had us going in, people will be happy with this. It's not particularly new. It's just a reemphasis of the desire and ability to be involved in what they call counterinsurgency, could also be called occupations. We're about to move resources from Iraq to Afghanistan to essentially do in Afghanistan what people claim we did in Iraq, but I'm not at all convinced that we have. I've got, obviously, some fundamental problems with the inclination that we should be doing these kinds of things when we haven't made a national determination that it's in our vital national interest to do that. There's two other parts to what Gates is doing, as Spencer was describing it. One was a set of hardware decisions. There's some pluses and some minuses. It looks very much to me like it's all budget neutral. People who think they're going to get savings out of this set of decisions, I think they're going to be disappointed, but they haven't shown us the numbers yet. A third part is what they call reform of the acquisition system, and I'm afraid I'm extremely skeptical about that too. I have all kinds of support for Secretary Gates and the hard work he put into this. I think he's genuine. I think he's trying very hard, but I don't think he's changed the direction of the ship of state called the Pentagon.
Again, Winslow Wheeler is now director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. Richard Abulafia is an analyst at the Teal Group. That's in Fairfax, Virginia. It's an aviation consulting firm, and it's good to have you on our program as well.
A pleasure.
What do you say, particularly with regard to what we heard earlier, the F-22?
Well, I think there was an enormous sound in Washington of a lot of head scratching yesterday because there were a few real bafflers. For one thing, Winslow Wheeler is pretty much exactly right. There weren't a whole lot of changes. People kept talking about program cancellations, and to be sure, there were a couple of those, but most of the major changes, the big headline news, was stuff that was program of record. The F-22 ended as the Bush administration had planned on. The C-17 ended as the Bush administration has planned on. The F-35 ramped up as the Bush administration had planned on. There's very little new here. Matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. The one really high-ticket platform that was killed, the Air Force's Combat Search and Rescue helicopter, was arguably the only new platform that might have been more relevant in a nation-building counterinsurgency type of strategic environment. So there's very little new here. You know, the one big takeaway I think I came away with yesterday was thinking that here you've got an administration that had campaigned that Iraq was a bad idea, and they're basically trying to remake the military to do more Iraqs. That seemed like a complete baffler to me as well.
Let me go back to Winslow Wheeler on that one. That's pretty much what you said as well, that this idea of counterinsurgency means more Iraqs. Do you think that they should be preparing for something else? Are there other threats? We heard earlier that one of the presumptions of the budget is that we don't at the moment have a threat from another nation that has the capability to give the United States much trouble.
I think you have to look at the way we prepare for the future in an intellectual sense. Anybody who says he knows today what the future of warfare is going to look like 10, 20 years from now, I can't trust them. There's a huge impetus now in the Pentagon to prepare for war with China, in addition to preparing for insurgency. I think that's the wrong intellectual framework. I think the correct intellectual framework is to prepare for an uncertain future. And that may sound like a cop-out, but it's how you think about things, and most importantly, how you prepare your military leadership for dealing with the future. We, unfortunately, going into Iraq, had a mindset of we do things one way, and it doesn't really matter whether it's a big dog or a small cat, we'll treat it the same way, and that turned out to be a real disaster. We need to rethink how we prepare our military officers and our civilian leadership, as a matter of fact, in the Pentagon, for understanding an uncertain future and learning how to be adaptive and able to cope with it, rather than to produce a laundry list where you check off, yeah, I'm ready for this, I'm ready for that. Oops, I guess I wasn't ready for that one.
When he made his announcement, the secretary indicated that he thinks he'll be criticized for focusing too much on current wars and not enough on future ones.
It is important to remember that every defense dollar spent to overinsure against a remote or diminishing risk, or in effect to run up the score in a capability where the United States is already dominant, is a dollar not available to take care of our people, reset the force, win the wars we are in, and improve capabilities in areas where we are underinvested and potentially vulnerable. That is a risk I will not take.
John Nagel is president of the Center for a New American Security. He is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and a veteran of both the Iraq wars. John Nagel, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
What do you take from what we just heard from the Secretary of Defense?
The Secretary of Defense is trying hard to turn an ocean liner. And he's taken what I think are very large steps toward doing so, dramatic changes given the history of weapon systems, which tend to acquire a momentum of their own and be incredibly hard to reverse or even slow down. And it's also not at all clear that he's going to get all of what he asked for. He had a wonderful analogy this morning. He said that 6 months ago, he punted the ball to the next Secretary of Defense on a number of these issues, and he has now found himself being that Secretary of Defense. And he caught the ball at his own one-yard line, looked up, and now he's got the entire Senate and House of Representatives running for him to try to prevent him from making some of these decisions. So it's going to be really sporting, I think, over the next couple of months to see what happens.
Sporting is an interesting word to use for this. Other than the F-22, which we've talked about a bit, what are the other dramatic changes?
He has stopped production of the new destroyer for the Navy at 3. He has dramatically restructured the Army's future combat system. He's stopped the procurement of all of, I believe, 8 is the last count of the different vehicles that were a part of that system. He's dramatically changed the Missile Defense Agency and a number of our missile programs. So there's a whole laundry list of changes which are probably individually mostly of interest to people in my business. In the aggregate, they attempt to decrease the focus of the Pentagon on fighting possible future wars while increasing the focus on fighting and winning the wars we're actually in, the counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, which many people, including the Secretary of Defense, think are likely to be the kind of wars we're most likely to fight in the near future.
So you think then that this is a major change, that it does reorient the Pentagon, or at least it attempts to, if the Congress will let the Defense Secretary get away with it?
It would be hard to imagine, in history, I can't think of a more dramatic series of changes all happening at the same time than the ones the Secretary of Defense announced yesterday. And the fact that we're talking about it now is an indication that something unusual has, in fact, happened.
Richard Apalafia, back to you. You don't seem to think so.
No, not really. You know, there's basically a lot of continuity in terms of the platforms. There's certainly this talk about reform, and that's certainly welcome. Some of it looks like it might make a meaningful contribution. There's talk about moving in the direction of counterinsurgency, but then again, that's kind of backwards in time. Iraq and Afghanistan, these look like the current strategic imperative, but are there a whole lot of other examples of countries that we would want to repeat this experience in? Or are we going to be at this level of operational use of our forces in 5 years in these places? I kind of doubt it. In terms of the budget itself, there's an awful lot that's pretty much steady state from the last administration.
Do you think that the budget then, the secretary said, we have to deal with the wars we're in now? You're suggesting that we're not going to be in this kind of war long enough to do this much preparation?
Well, I think there's a risk that you begin to think of this as the requirements that shape our long-term future, our long-term military future, because when you think about it, you're buying weapon systems that last 30 or 40 years. I can't imagine Iraq and Afghanistan being the pattern moving forward. And even if they are, I'm not so sure that there's the national political will to do them as just a consistent pattern of nation building and counterinsurgency. It also seems to me that if you equip your military for counterinsurgency, they're good at that and not much else, whereas with strategic capabilities, air power, sea power, you can accomplish an awful lot more in terms of diplomatic presence, in terms of war fighting, in terms of regional confrontation, any number of things. But if you focus on counterinsurgency, you have an awful lot of helicopters, mine-resistant ambush protection vehicles, everything like that, that would be basically useless if we return to the era of superpower strategic confrontation.
I think you need to leave us, and I want to thank you very much for being on our program.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Richard Apalafia, the analyst at the Thiel Group, at the Thiel Group in Fairfax. Again, that's an aviation consulting firm. Back to John Nagel. Too much continuity, says Mr. Apalafia. You say major change, almost revolutionary. This is a pretty wide, disparate difference of opinion.
I'm fascinated, actually, that he feels that way. I noticed that he did not note any other cases in which a Secretary of Defense had proposed such sweeping changes in the defense portfolio. And I think certainly since the end of the Cold War, this is the most dramatic change in priorities in terms of programs that any Secretary of Defense has announced. So I'm going to stand by my argument that the Secretary of Defense is trying very hard to reshape the Department of Defense to make it more capable for the wars we're actually fighting. I know that he's very disappointed by how hard he had to work to procure the two big programs that have been of most use to the soldiers in the field in Iraq and Afghanistan, the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, which have saved many, many soldiers and Marines' lives over the past several years, and the unmanned aerial vehicles, which have been very, very useful in breaking up insurgent rings in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and are also useful for targeting insurgents inside Pakistan. So both of those systems, which were major priorities over the past 2 years since he came into office as the Secretary of Defense, those both happened outside the normal procurement system. He had to go outside a system that was still designed to build systems for future wars in order to get the systems that the soldiers in the field actually needed. I think he was very frustrated by that, and he's trying hard to change the system to make it more responsive to the wars we're actually fighting rather than ones we planned to fight a number of years ago and procured systems that acquired momentum of their own that becomes very, very hard to change.
What about the argument of both Mr. Abulafia, who has left us, and Winslow Wheeler, who's still with us, that if you focus on the kinds of wars we're in now, you may be focusing on something that's not going to be necessary for very long, that we don't have either the political will or the expectation that we're going to have to go into other countries and the kind of force with the kind of force levels that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, so you're going to have a lot of the wrong kind of equipment sitting around.
Well, I certainly hope that that's the case. I've fought in both kind of wars. I fought in Desert Storm, a conventional tank-on-tank conflict, and I fought in a counterinsurgency campaign in Al Anbar in 2003 and 2004. My assessment is that our enemies learned from the experience of being defeated dramatically, very quickly on conventional battlefields, both in Desert Storm and in the early phases of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and realized that trying to confront the United States in conventional battle is a losing proposition. But if they try to fight us as insurgents, if they try to fight us using a protracted asymmetric strategy, using improvised explosive devices, guerrillas, snipers, they have a chance of exhausting us, of outlasting our will. And so my assessment is that that's the way they're going to try to fight us, where they have at least a chance. And therefore, we have to get just as good at that kind of war as we do at the conventional warfare, where we dramatically overpower them in very, very short order.
Winslow Wheeler, back to you at the Center for Defense Information. What about that?
Well, what Gates is trying to do, and what I think Lieutenant Colonel Nagle is totally revolutionary, and I don't, is that he's trying to institutionalize the impetus for what they call counterinsurgency. That's just a confirmation of a national strategy we've been on for some time. I should also point out
But Colonel Nagle just said that the reason we're on that strategy is that the enemies we are likely to face have discovered it works.
Well, I was going to get to that.
Okay.
That's one option. There are others. The Israelis ran into an option in Lebanon they weren't prepared to deal with because they were prepared, they thought, for a kind of guerrilla kind of opposition. They didn't get that. They got what some of the intellectuals are calling a hybrid form of warfare. It's just a more clever a response to the American predominance on conventional munitions and formations. There are all kinds of ways to exploit the weaknesses that we have in our very conventional mindset that are that lots of people are talking about. Guerrilla warfare is one, but it's certainly not the extent of the range.
So you're suggesting then that there's too much emphasis on what's called counterinsurgency. What else ought there then to be considered?
Well, there's a second part to this emphasis on counterinsurgency that needs to be discussed. It's a outlook that assumes that we need to go do these things in cases where our vital national interests are not absolutely involved, and there's a national consensus that our vital national interests are involved. The Clintons sort of started it with Kosovo, although that was obviously not a guerrilla situation, but it certainly was the mentality that Madeleine Albright had of, well, you've got this magnificent military, why don't you go use it some? And we use it for political ends to impact how other countries behaved in cases where our vital, direct, obvious national interests were not intimately involved. And the last president's administration, we got involved in these occupations, this occupation in Iraq, and I'm not quite sure how to characterize it in Afghanistan, but it's not been turning out well. And it's this sort of mindset of what America's role in the world is that accompanies the counterinsurgency attitude that we should feel free to go do these things in alien cultures that want to have no part of our presence there.
Very quickly, John Nagel, let me ask you to respond to that because I do want to go on to another question, and that is the kind of congressional battle we're going to see. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The President of the United States made it very clear not quite 2 weeks ago that the United States was involved in Afghanistan and in Pakistan for very good, hard national security reasons, that is, to defeat the Taliban and al-Qaeda and to keep America safe. The only way to do that is to build up Afghan and Pakistani capability to, over time, defend themselves. So the United States is committed to conducting counterinsurgency directly in Afghanistan, to helping the Pakistani military and government conduct counterinsurgency inside Pakistan in order to secure those two countries. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said correctly, in my eyes, that the most dangerous place in the world for America is Pakistan, the home of al-Qaeda, the Taliban, a very weak democratic government, and more than 100 nuclear weapons. So this isn't a question of optional wars in my eyes. We've seen what happens when we allow al-Qaeda a place to strengthen itself and to build inside Afghanistan. We can't allow that to happen again. I think it is the responsibility of any president to prevent that from happening. And so what the Secretary of Defense is doing correctly, in my eyes, is give our soldiers who are in harm's way now the ability to succeed in the war they're currently fighting, and which the president has just recommitted us to, and to try to increase our ability to fight those kind of wars in the future, to deter our enemies from choosing to fight us as guerrillas and insurgents in the future. I think that that's a very prudent course. The Secretary of Defense noted yesterday that this budget buys about 10% counterinsurgency and irregular warfare capability, 50% conventional war capability, and about 40% hybrid war capability. That's probably about right.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. John Nagel, again, at the think tank Center for a New American Security, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Winslow Wheeler at the Center for Defense Information, veteran of Capitol Hill. And our earlier guests, Richard Abulafia at the Thiel Group, and Spencer Ackerman with the Washington Independent. Good to have all of you on our program. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, we'll talk with a local congressman about defense cuts that impact Southern California. Also tonight, what are the Obama administration's plans for immigration reform? Back in a moment with Which Way LA. Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Southern California's last major airplane production line is in the Long Beach factory that turns out the C-17 cargo plane. It was slated to close in the summer of next year, but some congressmen were able to get it extended for another year. Now comes Secretary Gates' so-called reform budget. Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of Huntington Beach is senior member of the International Relations Committee. He's one of those concerned about the C-17. Dana Rohrabacher, good to have you on our program.
Well, good to be with you, Warren.
What's your understanding of the reform budget?
Well, my understanding of the reform budget as a whole, it means we're spending a lot more money in many other areas. We're bailing out all kinds of Wall Street wheeler dealers. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars to stimulate the economy to create jobs, yet we're going to cut programs like the C-17, where an important, valuable national asset is being paid for, and tens of thousands of jobs are already involved with making the project. It doesn't make any sense at all.
We talked earlier with Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information, who said he thinks that even though there are cuts, there's also so much new spending on different programs in the budget that it'll probably increase.
Well, when you spend money on non-capital assets, you will end up spending something. At the end of the day, you don't have anything to show for it. When you spend money on something like the C-17, and I just came back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I can tell you the C-17 is a workhorse. And if here we are trying to do to handle this conflict in Afghanistan, which the president is ratcheting up, we're going to need the C-17. It is an important asset. So it's not just spending; it's making sure you spend your money and you get something to show for it that's lasting afterwards.
It's a cargo plane, one of the biggest of all. Is it going to be needed also, do you think, to help withdraw troops from Iraq?
I think that it's not just for withdrawing troops. If we are going to project power anywhere in the world without having to have military bases there, we're going to need the type of capability that the C-17 gives us. By the way, the C-17 also, I've been working with Weyerhaeuser Corporation, and they've developed a system of, they're like big water balloons that can be put right in the back of a C-17 or a C-130, and it will turn these planes into firefighting aircraft without having to actually change the aircraft at all. So you've got, with that big ramp in the back for the C-17, you've got something that can sort of help us put out fires, but it can also be used by the military, and is not only just used, but it's vital for the military's role in projecting force across the world.
The Secretary of Defense is trying to change the priorities of the Defense Department somewhat. As far as jobs are concerned, there's a study by the University of Massachusetts at Amherst College, you may be familiar with it, that says that if you create jobs in healthcare, education, or spend the same amount of money in healthcare, education, mass transit, or home construction for weatherization and infrastructure, you actually create more jobs, and jobs that are just as good as you create if you spend in defense.
Actually, if you're only talking about creating jobs, it would be better for the government not to spend the money in the first place if that's the only criteria, meaning government-created jobs. And I agree that but we need to have a certain amount of money needs to be spent for our national defense. And when it comes to national defense, the C-17 plays an important role. And at a time when the economy it needs a stimulus. We're talking about we are now spending billions and billions of dollars in the name of creating jobs right now. So that study that you talked about wasn't part of a stimulus program. It was part of just an ordinary economic analysis. Well, in terms of a stimulus, you don't cut a program that employs thousands and thousands of people now at a time when you're spending billions of other dollars simply to stimulate the economy to create other jobs. Why? And especially after you've spent hundreds of billions of dollars bailing out Wall Street, and all they do is create paperwork and give themselves huge bonuses as a result.
Let me ask you about earmarks. It's been so controversial for such a long time. Some of your colleagues get heat for earmarks in the amount of a few million here and a few million there. Your earmarks for the 2010 budget amount to something like $13 billion. Dollars. Obviously, you're not trying to hide anything, but why are they so high?
Well, because what I have done is I've decided to agree to put my name beside different spending proposals that are absolutely what I consider to be essential, and not only defendable, but essential to national security and other areas. All these other people, they only put earmarks beside projects that are just going for their district. And don't really have much significance beside that. One thing that the public needs to know, and this whole idea that earmarks is an increase in spending, of course, is a total fraud. I mean, the issue, I think, is a fraudulent issue to begin with. When you say you have an earmark, you're not increasing the spending of the federal budget by that amount of money. You're only saying that if we have a defense budget by this amount, you have to spend a certain amount of that on the C-17, and I have no problem with saying that. If earmarks, and that's by the way with the other elements as well, whether they're doing things for their district, water projects, and things like that, they're not increasing the amount of money spent on water projects by the federal government. They're only saying that if the federal government spends this much money, this much has to be spent for this. For a particular project, rather than leaving the decision to unelected officials. So I think this the public's been sold a bill of good on earmarks. I'm more frugal than 90% of these other people who have just a small number of earmarks, but they I'm more frugal than they are. I'm just saying that I'll vote for lower levels of federal spending, but I'm willing to put my name beside specific spending items.
Congressman, one more question. You, as a Republican, were in the majority for a long time. How painful, how difficult is it for you now that the Democrats have been in charge?
I'm just sitting down and watching all of this stuff go around me, where when the Republicans were in, I used to sort of think that at least I had some impact. But now, when you're sitting there watching these hundreds of billions of dollars of spending just zoom through the process, I mean, we've spent, $1 trillion, and people do not know where that money went. And we know that, in this package, in the bailout bill, the original bailout bill, we know that probably at least $100 billion of it went to Chinese banks.
Yeah, but George Bush had a surplus when he came in, and he left with an enormous deficit.
Absolutely. I'm not a George Bush fan. I never have been.
Okay.
I've always George Bush always wanted to talk about being the compassionate conservative, and he ends up, instead of being the compassionate conservative, he ended up being the spendthrift conservative who wanted to police the world. I'm sorry, we can't police the whole world. We can't afford it. And we can't afford to take to cure every problem in Africa by spending $100 billion there. But Bush just, I was never a fan of George's.
All right, we're going to leave it at that. Dana Rohrabacher, independent Republican congressman from Huntington Beach, senior member of the International Relations Committee. Thanks a lot.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. An immigration raid in the state of Washington took Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano by surprise. Now, all but one of the 28 workers arrested have been released, and a change of policy appears to be in store. New guidelines have been drawn up, but they're being kept secret. What about those who supported Barack Obama in hopes of seeing immigration reform? Angelica Salas is executive director of CHURLA. That's the Coalition for Humane Immigration Rights of Los Angeles. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Have your expectations been dashed, or are you still waiting?
Well, I think that we understand that this administration is dealing with some very critical matters, and of course, it's the economy, and really moving this country forward on other critical issues that also matter to immigrants, like health care reform and certainly extending employee rights in the workplace. So we understand that the immigration is a national priority for this administration, and that it will be moved on. I think the way that we are working is the understanding that this president was brought into office because a lot of new citizens, a lot of Latino voters who cared a lot about immigration, actually voted because they wanted change and they wanted to see a different policy. And that raids in work sites or home raids, that's where individuals are visited in their home or in the early hours of the morning and very coordinated actions, that was not going to make situation better. In fact, that we don't see it as a solution, and that we needed new leadership that would actually pass comprehensive immigration reform.
What about the raids at workplaces, and what about the what degree of anxiety is there at the moment because there hasn't been any clear policy enunciated as yet?
Well, what we have seen are indications from Janet Napolitano that enforcement in the style of the massive raids was not going to be a policy that was going to continue, and that the enforcement was now, at least some of the indications, is that there's going to be targeted to employers. We're still not satisfied with that because we think that it should be targeted to unscrupulous employers. Those are employers who are violating labor law, who are violating immigration law, and violating any other laws that will undercut their competitors and actually maintain workers vulnerable. So what we expect from the administration is that very quickly they will provide us the details of this new change in policy, that the president will articulate forcefully his intention to move on immigration reform this year, and that he will engage the leaders of other countries that are very much connected to this issue, involved in a discussion about the legalization of the 12 million people who currently live in this country without status.
What does immigration reform then mean to you, in a brief summary, if you can?
Sure, no. Immigration reform means legalizing the 12 million people who are currently in this country without legal status. And then it means dealing with the bureaucracy that actually creates a backlog of 12 to 20 years in order to legalize your status, to come in with a legal visa. It means providing worker protections for both native-born but also immigrants in the workplace. And it means due process and civil rights, so that individuals who are non-citizens are actually treated in the courts fairly, and that they're actually provided with legal counsel in order to protect their rights. So, when we think of immigration reform as a policy that all Americans are invested in which we have labor, business, community organizations like ourselves, immigrant rights organizations, all working together to move forward this policy.
Angelica Salas, Executive Director of the Coalition for Humane Immigration Rights of Los Angeles, called CHURLA. Roberto Suro is a former director of the nonpartisan research organization Pew Hispanic Center. He's now a journalism professor at the Edinburgh School for Communication at USC. And, Professor, it's good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you.
Is this a good time? Immigration apparently is down considerably. Illegal immigration is down. Is this a good time to bring up this issue and to engage in the kind of reform that Angelica Salas is talking about, or might there be a backlash?
Well, I mean, it's a good time as a policy matter. It may not be a good time as a political matter. It makes sense in terms of policy to set up an immigration system when the flows are down, to look forward to when the economy heats up again and demand for foreign workers grows again, and have a system where that demand is met through a legal supply. Politically, you know, the economy's lost more than 5 million jobs since immigration was debated the last time. And the basic argument that was made during the last debate, that the economy had more demand for workers than could be met domestically, is now not easily made. So the landscape has changed. And you can see that in the way the president's talking about the issue. He's taken temporary workers and future flows pretty much off the table. I mean, when he talks about what he's hoping to accomplish, he's not talking about some of those elements that were very controversial in the Bush plans.
So what about amnesty, as it's called by some, legalization, as it's called by others?
The president, when he's addressed the issue, has emphasized two pieces: one, enforcement at the work site, and two, a legalization program for all the people who are currently here out of status, with an eventual path to citizenship. So he's pretty very much on the record supporting a program of that kind.
Okay, again, Roberto Suro, now professor at the Edinburgh School for Communication at USC. Stephen Camerata is director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies. That's in Washington, think tank that advocates for stronger immigration restrictions. And Steve Camerata, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What does immigration reform mean to you?
Well, I think that what we should do is step back and think about what's in the best interest of our country. You know, what is the best interest of American workers, the health care system, the education system? And I think that most people recognize that a more moderate pace of immigration would make sense. Barbara Jordan, who headed a commission in the 1990s, looked long and hard at this question.
She was Texas Congresswoman. Go ahead.
Yes, the first African-American elected from the South. And she made a series of, I think, very practical recommendations, which was enforce the law, don't have an amnesty, focus on employers in particular, you have to police the border, and bring down immigration instead of allowing in over a million legal immigrants a year, get rid of some of the chain migration that allows people to bring in an endless number of family members. You know, you can now sponsor, you know, your brother, who then when he comes, he brings his wife, children, and then his wife can sponsor her family members. So eliminate those chain migration that creates a kind of endless stream. So in the way she thought about it was, her word was, Americanize the immigrants here. In other words, bring immigration more in line with public opinion to a more moderate pace that we can then better incorporate and assimilate immigrants and take some of the pressure off social services as well. And most one of her biggest concerns was to take pressure off the bottom end of the labor market, where wages have generally declined and we have a real surplus of labor, and we did 2 years ago as well, because the unemployment rates for the least educated have remained very high, and their wages over the last 30 years are about 22% less than they used to be. So I think, for me, immigration reform sort of means step back and think about what's best for the country, and I think the Jordan Commission had to balance a lot of things, and I think they got it right.
Well, let's talk about the politics of the moment. It appears that the coalition that supported immigration reform when President Bush was in charge has now fallen apart, particularly because business has different interests now. It doesn't need to recruit workers from overseas. What do you think that President Obama is going to do to satisfy his constituents and to avoid a possible backlash from people who are opposed to immigration?
Yeah, I think that he'd like to. He'd like President Bush. He sincerely believes in a legalization or amnesty, whichever term you like. And like President Bush, he sees immigration enforcement as kind of morally dubious at best. However, the political reality is that given the rates of unemployment and the job losses, it's not very likely that people could introduce the legislation, but that actually would move forward. So the thing he's likely to do is to try to give to the advocacy groups within the Democratic Party, ethnic advocacy groups, is he's likely to give them at least one thing, which is a cutback in enforcement. What he's going to say is, well, I'll go after employers, and everybody agrees with that. That is an excellent idea. It is clearly in a neglected area. But it's not clear if it's going to be meaningful. It's hard to go after and make cases against employers under current law. The law should be changed. And he's going to curtail probably enforcement. The problem is, in doing that, then he's going to undermine his enforcement credibility when down the road, say in a year or two, when he does try to get the amnesty or legalization passed, he's going to promise that from now on he's going to enforce the law. But everybody who objects is going to be able to legitimately say, hey, wait a minute.
Okay.
You had a year and a half, and you didn't enforcement. Why would we believe you now? But he's kind of stuck in this box. He's got to give the advocates something, but that something may work against the long-term goals that he has.
Stephen Camerata of the Center for Immigration Studies. Back to Angelica Salas with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. I presume you would be one of those who is an advocate. How do you see the president's situation at this point, and is cutting enforcement something that you would like to see happen?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think that we are also pushing for an immigration policy that is working for the best interest of the American public, and we think that the enforcement-only policies that have been put in place under the Bush administration and before him are expensive and they just don't work. So that even immigration enforcement has skyrocketed. We basically have paid billions and billions of dollars to reinforce the border, to do these kind of worksite raids. And at the end of the day, the undocumented population has tripled. So obviously that policy doesn't work. And I think that that taxpayers really want to see a solution in which the individuals who are currently working in this country, who have roots, who are without immigration status, actually have their legal documents. And I think that we also believe that legalization actually will increase government revenues in this very difficult economy. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is certainly not taking any of these positions other than the what is the revenue stream, and they estimated that about $66 billion in new revenue would be generated over 2 years if the 2006 immigration reform bill would have passed. So that we also have to think in the interest of this nation, are we willing to continue to be throwing taxpayer dollars at a failed system, or are we prepared to invest in this community that has invested in this nation, that has roots and has family in this nation? And I think that the president, our expectation is that he is going to see that the best interest for this country is to move on a legalization program.
Okay.
And
now,
to look at
the
bureaucracy and also to look at the system, which really prevents anybody from coming in legally.
Back to Professor Suro at the Annenberg School for Communication. Do you agree with Stephen Camerota that if only cutting enforcement is what the president does and is able to do, then he may have trouble down the line because he won't have credibility with those who are concerned about this issue once the demand for workers increases again?
Yeah, and I think the administration has made it clear that they're reviewing the enforcement measures, particularly in terms of worksite raids, as part of a larger review of immigration policies and in a larger context of immigration reform. The worksite raids alone caused an awful lot of anxiety and disruption in a lot of communities, and it's not clear what impact they've had politically for the administration. There are significant costs to maintain them, which is why we've had sort of a de facto suspension of the worksite raids. And I suspect that there's going to be the president's going to start talking about immigration fairly soon, although not with a specific calendar. But the first step there is going to be articulating a new policy on the current enforcement efforts.
Well, will he go after employers?
I think there's no question about the intent to how they actually go about it. There are a lot of questions, which is one of the reasons I think they've not announced a new policy, because it's not so easy to do under current law. Other administrations have done it, and it's difficult to bring prosecutions under the existing law.
You have to prove that the employer knew that the worker was, in fact, illegal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you really get the people who, in the most egregious and obvious cases, and they're it's very hard to prosecute sort of the routine employer who doesn't look too closely at the documents that workers present. But in the long term, both Secretary Napolitano at DHS and the president have made it clear that they want a new employer verification system with a database where legitimate potential employees could be checked in some form of identification so that an employer would know who they were talking to.
Okay, quickly, we're almost out of time. What about the populist anger in the country right now? Is this an issue that has the potential to attract that and bring it to the debate?
Well, I mean, this is a difficult question. There's an awful lot of anger out there. Right now, it's got big targets like AIG bonuses and Bernie Madoff and all kinds of other sort of inviting places to aim populist anger. You have to wonder whether if you start a full-scale immigration debate now, whether some of that anxiety would then shift over towards immigration as it has in the past.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you all for being with us. Obviously, a progress report on what's happening with immigration. Roberto Suro at the Annenberg School for Communication, Angelica Salas at CHRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigration Rights, and Stephen Camerota of the Center for Immigration Studies. Which Way LA, produced tonight by Sonia Geis and Katie Cooper. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner. Technical director, Mario Saavedra. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/WhichWayLA. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA, 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.